Hello, and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
He served in the military for more than 30 years, witnessed the horrors of the Rwandan genocide, saved thousands of lives, and served in the Senate for nearly a decade. Now, former General Romeo Dallaire is calling on Canadians to take on a larger peacekeeping role around the world. Dallaire sits down for a one-on-one.
Is the internet age killing free speech? That's the argument from Tom Flanagan, a former advisor to Prime Minister Stephen Harper, who lost his job and was shunned by the political world after he suggested viewing child pornography doesn't do any harm. Flanagan speaks to us about his book, which details the controversy, the fallout from his comments, and the impact social media has on politics.
Every day, beautiful songs ring from the bells of the Peace Tower on Parliament Hill. We sit down with the woman behind the sound. Canada's Dominion Carolyn Ure discusses her work and the future of the music that echoes through the Capitol. For your politics, for your power, welcome to the Hill. This past spring, Romeo Dallaire retired from the Senate after serving in the upper chamber for nearly a decade. Dallaire is, of course, the Canadian general who gained world renown after heading an ill-fated UN mission in Rwanda when the genocide broke out in 1994. While people were being brutally tortured and murdered, Dallaire used his small contingent of peacekeeping troops to try and save as many as they could from the massacre. His team is credited with saving thousands of lives.
Dallaire stepped down from the Senate to devote more time to issues like combating the use of child soldiers, championing the rights of veterans, and urging world action in strife-torn countries such as the Central African Republic. But he used his final Senate speech to urge Canada to take on a much bigger role in UN peacekeeping missions. And that was the focus of the conversation when McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes sat down for an interview with Dallaire.
I specifically want to talk to you because I was so fascinated by your final speech in the Senate. And in particular, how you framed a vision of Canada's role in the world. There was a part, though, near the start where you touched on your own experience. You talked about how when people like you who've been in the field read news stories from conflict zones, for you it's a visceral thing. It's a real thing. You hear the screams of the people. It was very moving, the screams of the people who are being attacked, the sounds of conflict. But you also said, I'm actually going to read this. You said, we smell what is out there. We still smell it. What goes on in these conflict zones is not foreign and should never be foreign to a great nation like ours. I want to start by asking you about that, and I hope this doesn't seem like a small-minded question, but for a lot of Canadians, those conflicts are foreign. They're in distant places, the Central African Republic, Syria. These are places that it's hard for many Canadians to connect to our own existences. What would you say to people like that who think, no, these are someone else's problem. We shouldn't be worrying about those parts of the globe.
Boy, that you're articulating exactly the natural reaction. I mean, you do that when another town has a problem. You know, the company town closes down. Your company is still there. You say, well, geez, you know, that's too bad for them. But you know, that's life. You know, they got to sort it out. So I mean, we do that even amongst ourselves, including even the neighbor. Yeah. Let alone, how do you handle a country that is perceived to be so foreign and far away? And so one is that people are reacting naturally to that, and that's what you're reflecting. The question, however, is that the depth of Canadians? I mean, is simply the natural reaction of your own self-preservation the end state, and then you carry on, you know, to hell with them. Then I've got my things, and you know, tough. And I am arguing that we've been able to move this nation over the 150 years and through the way, the values, the essence of our communities, and our perspective of who we are, we've been able to move that argument higher. The question is are people reminded of that level? That we are not just self-centered and requiring and surviving, let alone thriving here, but that we do sense that we are part of humanity.
Obviously, we associate you with the horrific episode in Rwanda 20 years ago now. Mm. But beyond the terror of that situation, you brought from it a kind of a strategic insight, I think, into Africa, into foreign intervention in Africa. You've talked about how the late French-led bid to kind of intervene in Rwanda ended up being a disaster and, in fact, prolonged the carnage there. I don't want to revisit all of that, but is that episode that you talked about in your Senate speech not a kind of cautionary tale about how foreign intervention can go wrong? You know, that the history, the circumstances in these places, complicated conflict zones, is often, you know, it's hard to game out what's going to happen. To going along the theme of my original skeptical question, isn't that also reason for caution? We look at cases where foreign countries have tried to intervene, and it's all gone wrong.
I think caution is being responsible. Leaders have to have a certain caution as they assess risk. But caution isn't the excuse for sitting on your ass and doing nothing, because inaction is an action. Not wanting to do something is a deliberate decision that you take of not wanting to do something.
Right,
so
right.
It's not as if, oh, gee, you know, we're letting it go by. No, you've decided to let it go by. So the question is why are these countries like us, these middle powers, abdicating to letting the colonial powers do what we believe is absolutely wrong, is continuing to nurture this link between the ex-colonial power and the people? Because when the people are up Shit Creek with no capability, all of a sudden they count on the colonial power to come back in.
So you're arguing for a vision of a robust middle power role for countries like Canada, and I don't know what other countries you'd put in that category.
Hey, Pearson, when he came out in 56 with the concept of peacekeeping, it was very much a Chapter 6 mission, meaning you're there to observe an agreement between, and in those days it was nation states. So it was pretty easier, much easier to establish than today, where you have imploding nations and it's people from the same country going at each other in civil wars. So it's far more complex, far more ambiguous than it was in those days when nations were literally at each other. Mm. But Pearson argued in his writings and in his speeches at the UN that you needed a robust military capability to back up the diplomatic capabilities and ultimately economic ones if you have that. Mm. So it was never, you know, we're going to become peacekeeper, we're going to be good guys and we won't have to use force if necessary to protect people. He believed that you needed a solid military, credible, because in extremis you don't have to use them.
Hmm. General, before I lose the train of Canada's kind of middle power involvement abroad, could you sketch what you think Canada should be doing in the Central African Republic?
Yes. Canada should have a battle group of about 1,600 with a helicopter capability to be able to move at least a company at a time, which means a squadron of helicopters, mostly 412s, but preferably a half squadron of Chinooks. It should have engineering capability and certainly an extensive logistic and command control. So the divisional headquarters be there and run the mission. We can be the backbone of that UN come African Union force.
But that's not going to happen, right? I mean, because the government is afraid of going into Africa. I assume it's a residue of Rwanda, Somalia.
There is interesting. Was running through National Defense Headquarters. We don't want to do a Dallaire anymore.
Yeah.
But not wanting to do a Dallaire anymore meant sending a general with a couple staff officers into a mission where we should have sent the general with a battalion,
which
I asked for and never got, into, because I was told all our troops are going into Yugoslavia. We could have done it. I was just coming out of command of a brigade, so that's three battalions. So there is a firm belief that if we're going in anywhere and taking on, we must put a capability on the ground, and I totally agree. If I had a Canadian battalion, it would have been different. But what is still nurtured in there is this NATO-itis. You know, well, we don't really like how UN builds mandates and builds its force and the command and control and strategic planning. But we do like the NATO one, so we're going to work with NATO. Hmm. And so if NATO is called in, well, we'll look in. But if NATO is not called in, well, we're really not keen on doing it. And that comes from the fact that Canada like many other countries, pulled back from the 101 reforms that Kofi Annan brought in 2005 that got shot to hell, in which we can be reinforcing and improving the UN capability. But we're not even trying to do that. Not only we're not sitting at the table, we're not even putting troops in the field enough to be able to influence it anymore.
So if I'm a Canadian out there reading Maclean's or listening to this, and I'm thinking the general has his heart in the right place, but I don't want to see Canadian troops dying in a jungle or a desert somewhere, what do you say to them?
It's interesting. How long have we been in Cyprus? 60 years.
Right.
Very close.
Right.
And they're not killing each other anymore. Haven't for a while. We're still patrolling this line between them. They're still discussing. And the way it's going, it might take another generation, so another 20 years before they decide, you know, we really don't need this line anymore. We can work this out, and we don't need to be monitored by the UN. So what's 70 years in the life of a nation if they're not killing each other, they're building a future, and they're economically sort of aligning their capabilities? 70 years is not too bad. Mm. So, Afghanistan as an example, and many of the other countries, the Yugoslavia, the Rwandas, the Sierra Leones, nations that are in tumultuous scenarios. I mean, we didn't all evolve like Canada and the United States. Some of them started from a way back, including us setting them up to fail.
Yes.
By first of all, creating these weird, sometimes, boundaries, and secondly, by keeping them, subjugating them, which some countries still try to do. And certainly my French friends, I've argued that with them a lot. So you need to invest in giving them an ability to be able to nurture the future. And those of us who have the capacity to do that should be doing it. So we do it economically, development-wise, but we should also be prepared to do it security-wise if things go awry, if people want to, don't want to share power, as an example, or resources and abuse one part of the country to another, like Darfur, as an example. So we go in, it's more dangerous, more complex, ambiguous. Civil war is very difficult to define. But we went into Afghanistan for 10 years. So who said that the mission was going to take 10 years? Where was that written that, oh, we're going to sort this out in, you know, 2 or 3 years and then we'll be home by Christmas? Hmm. That bullshit is still around, particularly this hill, where we need very clear sort of end states, we need very clear objectives, and we want to avoid casualties. Well, you might as well stay home, and if you're going to send anybody, send the Boy Scouts. There is no such realm anymore in the world. Afghanistan needs 40, 50, 60, 70 years of assisting them. You may not have to fight, you may not have to, but you got to assist them, you got to wear it down, you got to attrit, you got to work with them to build the capacity of bringing in human rights and gender equality and a bureaucracy, rule of law. I mean, you don't do that. Rwanda, they wanted Rwanda to have a democratic election in 2 years after 3 years of civil war, 25 years of a dictator, and 150 years of colonial power. Now, what idiot brings that in? We created the responsibility to protect, where we said, the world said, if somebody is massively abusing the human rights of his people, sovereignty is not an absolute. We can go in to protect them.
Right.
So why should we go in to protect them? Apart, you know, the human rights dimension. Well, maybe we can readjust the self-interest by saying, one, you create these massive refugee camps and internally space camps, you are festering pandemics because it's created there, it's nurtured there, and it spreads. Mm. So, hey, we might have pandemics here. Secondly, it nurtures rage, and rage nurtures terrorism and extremism. Well, geez, that stuff can be exported to us here. So maybe we're creating a risk to ourselves by continuing this rage. Third, it's usually in countries where there are resources that are important to us, like coltan and stuff like that. So we might be assisting illegal or non-ethical sort of extraction where, in fact, we should be resolving it. And fourth, it creates enormous amounts of tensions within the diasporas in our own cities, who are not divorced from what's going on because of social communications now. They're more linked than they ever were. And so how do you keep your people who are here, the diaspora, focused when they see such complicated problems there? And will those problems sneak in here? Like recruitment of young people here to go fight in countries overseas. So it's in our self-interest that what happens in Sierra Leone, what happens in Central African Republic or Mali, it's in our self-interest to sort it out there because it's coming here.
General, thank you very much for talking to us. It's fascinating to listen to you.
Well, you're very kind, and thanks for coming by.
That was McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes in conversation with Romeo Dallaire, retired general and former Liberal senator.
Coming up, Tom Flanagan writes about his political blacklisting following his controversial comments about child pornography, and we speak with the woman behind the music from the Peace Tower on Parliament Hill. Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
Still to come on the show, we speak with Canada's Dominion Carolyn Ure about the music she creates from the bells in the Peace Tower. But first...
At one time, you're on top of the world, working in the highest office of the land. And just a few short years later, you're in the pits of political despair. Some say that's just politics. And none would know better than Tom Flanagan.
In February 2013, the former strategist and close advisor to Prime Minister Stephen Harper made headlines for comments he made about child pornography. While speaking to a crowd at the University of Lethbridge in Alberta, Flanagan suggested the act of viewing child porn images does not harm another person and questioned whether those people should be put in jail. Flanagan apologized for his comments, saying his words were poorly chosen, but the incident still cost him his job with the Alberta Wildrose Party and at the University of Calgary, although since then he's returned to the university to teach a course in public policy.
After taking time off to reflect, Flanagan wrote a book about his experience titled Persona Non Grata, The Death of Free Speech in the Internet Age. McLean's political editor Paul Wells was able to speak with Flanagan over the phone.
First of all, were you at all nervous about rehashing all of this in print? It was a very difficult period in your life. Do you want to live it again?
Yeah, I had those thoughts, sure. And there are some things I don't look forward to seeing in print again. But, I felt I had to write the book because the book was my way of coming to understand what had happened. So some friends said, don't do it, just let it go. But in the end, I felt it was the right thing to do.
Okay. Tell me about that day of February 28th, 2013, when you were in the car and when you came out, a lot had happened.
Well, it was unreal, really, or surreal. I got up that morning, had breakfast, got in the car, and started driving back to Calgary. Didn't think there was any particular problem at all. And about halfway there, my car phone buzzed. It was a couple of people who worked for Danielle Smith calling, and that was the first I knew that there was a problem, and I described that in my book. So they sent me the text of the news release that they were about to put out. I just kept driving, and then I didn't really realize the scope of things until I got back to my office and could look at my email, and then I saw that the tsunami had rolled in. So it was very, very odd that I didn't know what was going on, and then suddenly it was huge.
The inciting event was a YouTube video of some remarks you had made in a public forum on another subject altogether.
Right.
I had been
invited to speak on campus at the University of Lethbridge on the Indian Act, and I'd been invited by a town and gown organization there. It's been around for many, many years. So I spoke about the Indian Act, and then we had this Q&A afterwards, and this question came up about remarks I had made in passing about child pornography several years ago in a completely different context. And so I tried to answer the question and tried to explain what I had been getting at, but it wasn't possible. In that forum, it was a largely hostile audience. stacked with, I don't know, war adherents from local reserves. So, you know, then I just gave up on that whole point. And then we went back to talking about the Indian Act. So this, you know, that exchange took up maybe 2 minutes out of an event that lasted 2.5 hours. And it was completely off topic. And so leaving the room, I didn't even think of it as particularly important. Nobody mentioned it later. It only became important because the whole thing was a trap. The people that I mean, I don't mean the whole event was a trap, but that question was a trap that had been asked with the intent of recording my answer and trying to get something that could be used to discredit me. So then it was put up on YouTube overnight with the false caption, the Flanagan okay with child pornography, which is, you know, not what I had said and not what I think. But once that went out, in the morning, that really took on a life of its own. And I think people just saw the caption and maybe looked at the video and didn't understand the context and had no real idea of what I had been trying to say.
If you had been able to respond immediately to questions and to the sort of avalanche of reaction, could you have cut this story short, or were you already doomed as soon as you spoke?
By the time I was able to do something about it, it was too late, I think. You know, if I had been an organization with people to help me, you know, it might have been different. But at this point in my life, I'm just an individual professor at the university and didn't have any staff, nobody to help me deal with it. So as an individual, I think it was hopeless at that point.
Who, during all of this, who stood up for you? Did anyone?
That took a little time. The answer is yes. First of all, individually, I immediately started getting a flood of email and phone calls from friends who, and not necessarily even friends, in some cases people I didn't even know, but who were appalled by what was going on, and they got in touch, started to get in touch that afternoon, and some of them started writing about it within a day or two. Columns started to appear in various outlets. So yeah, people did stand up for me, but it was after the main damage had been done. You know, the damage was done by the headlines ricocheting around the country. Flanagan forced to retire, you know, Flanagan okay with child pornography, this kind of stuff. So it's what gets out there first that does the damage. And I think maybe if you're an organization, you could do something about it. But for an individual, once that wave of damaging publicity has gone out, you know, you can try and post, get people can write in your favor and restore a sense of balance. But I don't think you ever undo the damage that's caused by the first wave.
Now, in the book, you write about the sort of uncomfortable resonance that this has with the recent history of the Conservative Party and the Conservative movement. In 2004, you ran a campaign that depended sometimes on cutting loose candidates who had become inconvenient, and also a campaign that the Federal Conservative campaign that one of the strangest days was about a communications piece that went out about Paul Martin and child pornography.
Yes.
So was this karma?
Well, it's kind of ironic, isn't it? I managed the 2004 campaign. The way our Division of Labor was set up, I really had almost nothing to do with communications, and so the release about Paul Martin and child pornography went out without my having seen it. But if I'd seen it, I don't know if I would have done anything different. Like, I'm not trying to dodge responsibility here. Yeah, I was campaign manager, and our campaign manager did go after Paul Martin on that, even though it was Stephen didn't want it to have. He had never been consulted either. But I think that illustrates the difference. You know, Paul Martin was the head of a large, powerful political party, and they could fight back, whereas an individual doesn't really have that ability. But yeah, it is kind of ironic, isn't it, that
Your book also airs other criticisms of the Conservative Party and of the Prime Minister. The falling out between you and Stephen Harper seems to be pretty complete. At one point you write, there's a dark, almost Nixonian side to the man. He can be suspicious, secretive, and vindictive, prone to sudden eruptions of white-hot rage over meaningless trivia, at other times falling into week-long depressions in which he's incapable of making decisions. Let me ask bluntly, is that the sort of thing that would disqualify a guy from being prime minister?
No, I don't think so. I tried to be clear that this is one side of a complex person, and he also has many wonderful attributes as well. And, you know, and I feel proud that he asked me to work for him. I believe I helped him get where he is today. You know, he's obviously intelligent and dedicated and focused and honest in his way of, you know, I can't see him ever taking a bribe, for example. He doesn't care about money. I mean, he has all these great characteristics, too. So he's a complicated person, and this is another side of him. Does it disqualify him from being prime minister? No, I don't think so. I think many leaders have complicated personalities with an unattractive side.
Okay. I guess the last thing I want to ask about is there a lesson in your experience for other people? I mean, the genesis of this is fairly esoteric. Don't take questions on child pornography at conferences on treaty law. But can it be generalized more?
Well, yeah. First of all, I should not have tried to answer the question. I should have said, look, that's irrelevant to the topic for tonight. The reason that I tried to answer it was because I was in my university frame of mind. You know, I had been back teaching at the university. I was invited to give a lecture on university campus. I think there is a real problem that I have become increasingly aware of. I wasn't aware of it when I first got drawn into the political world, of the difference between the university world and the political world. Politics is all about building coalitions of support to gain power or to overthrow people in power. University world is, it sometimes gets invaded by politics, but basically university world is about trying to find out what's true about the universe and about human beings and society and culture and all of that. And they are different activities. And so somebody from the university world that gets drawn into politics becomes kind of schizophrenic by necessity, because if you follow your university instincts, you won't last and you can't work effectively in any kind of political capacity. So I'm not sure there is a single lesson here, except for anybody who has a serious university career ought to think twice about getting drawn into partisan politics. I mean, it's okay to be a government advisor or to be what I've often done, an expert witness in litigation. You can bring your knowledge and your expertise to bear without the kind of risk that you undergo when you become part of the political machine. The general warning, I would say, is for somebody who has a serious commitment to academic life, you'd better think pretty carefully before responding to invitations from politicians to join up in their enterprises, because they obviously will drop you as soon as you become inconvenient to them.
That was McLean's political editor Paul Wells speaking with Tom Flanagan about his book, Persona Non Grata, The Death of Free Speech in the Internet Age.
Coming up, we speak with Canada's Dominion Carolyn Ure about her art and fears about the future of the music from the Peace Tower on Parliament Hill. Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine. If you've ever visited Parliament Hill around midday, you'll hear beautiful songs ringing from the bells of the Peace Tower and echoing through the streets of Ottawa. In this day and age, many may think it's an automated system playing, but you may be surprised to learn that there is someone sitting in a small room in the Peace Tower, seven stories up, hitting every note. They play an instrument called the carillon, which looks similar to an organ but is attached to the 53 bells that hang in the belfry.
Now, I had a chance to go up to that room and watch Canada's Dominion caroloneer, Dr. Andrea McCready, as she played her set. She speaks with me about her work, her vast repertoire, and her fears about the future of Canada's most recognized carillon.
So I guess the first question is, how does someone get into this job?
Well, the job itself became an international competition when my predecessor, Gordon Slater, retired. The government advertised it as usual on the government website. No qualified Canadians applied, so they expanded the search worldwide. And that's how I heard about it. At the time, I was finishing my second bachelor's degree. My first was years and years ago in history, and I decided to go back to university and get a music degree. And I had other plans, but when I heard about this competition, I said, wow, Peace Tower, Ottawa, that would be great. I didn't think I had a snowball's chance, but I lucked out. Anyhow, but originally I came to the carillon from a piano background. I studied piano when I was 6 years old on into my undergraduate years, and my undergraduate Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut, had a lovely 30-bell carillon on campus played by a student club, and I went up and said, wow, this is a keyboard, and it sounds fabulous. I'd like to do this. So for the first 4 years, it was just fun with the club, and then I was very lucky before I went off to graduate study at McGill at medical school. I got a independent study fellowship to go study the carillon in Europe for a whole year. And from then on, you know, I never gave it up.
How does it feel playing in the Peace Tower? I mean, you've been doing it for years.
Well, that's a tricky question. For the first few decades, when I was up at McGill, I came down and played guest recitals from time to time. And, of course, that was always a great thrill. The thrill is always there. Now it's a day-to-day job. It's a full-time job. I play year-round, whether Parliament's sitting or not. And in fact, when Parliament isn't sitting in the summer, that's my busiest time. I switch from 15-minute noontime recitals to full hour-long recitals. And, of course, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of tourists on the ground hearing it. But they can't see me.
Since they can't see it, I guess we'll describe it for our listeners as well. Why don't we walk over here right now? I mean, how difficult is it to play this? It looks very difficult with all these wooden knobs sticking out like this.
Okay, so we have 53 bells in the tower that do not swing. They're bolted to the bell frame, and the only thing that moves is the clapper. And the clapper is attached to the keyboard by a wire transmission system. We have two rows of manual keys arranged like the black and white keys of a piano or an organ, except that they're wooden levers farther apart. So we can't play with our fingertips. Instead, we turn our hands 90 degrees and play as if we were a drummer without the sticks. In addition, the lowest 29 bells, the heaviest bells, attach through the manuals to the pedals, and we can play with our feet on the heavy bells. It looks awkward, it looks physical, but you learn to make the instrument do the work, and we can play with expression, loud or soft, with both our hands and our feet.
Watching you play reminds me of watching an organist in a church. Is it similar? Is it a similar feel for you?
I never played the organ. I approach this as if it's a piano. So I like the fact that it's a touch-sensitive instrument, and I can play expressively, loud and soft and so forth, with both my hands and my feet. Yes, organists, you may think, have the advantage of already learning how to play with their feet. I had to add that language last. But it's a very different technique than an organist would use. Even organists have to learn how to play it very differently.
Let's talk about your repertoire. I walk up to the hill sometimes, and I can't believe some of the songs I'm hearing. So what's in your playbook?
Well, we draw from an ever-growing repertoire of music directly composed for the carillon, but I also have to do a lot of adaptation and of course, I start every day with O Canada. People ask me, what's my favorite piece? I can say that because I play it every day. And fortunately, I like it very much. The music I like the most to play is the music composed for the carillon because it gives it its best voice. But it's fun to do a lot of arranging, and yes, I do a few musical jokes from time to time to catch people's attention.
Like what? What kind of songs do you love to play to sort of catch people off guard as they're walking up to the hill, as you have done for me many times before?
I think probably the most notorious was a few years back when Parliament was to resume in September, and I played a medley of Disney tunes starting with Hi-ho, hi-ho, it's off to work we go, and whistle while you work, and so forth. And everybody laughed at that one. I play with, I think, taste, but it's kind of fun.
I've heard you play the Beatles as well.
I did, and so everything from With a Little Help from My Friends to John Lennon's Imagine and Dizzy Miss Lizzie, stuff like that.
You mentioned earlier that you also play some new music, some hip-hop, stuff that maybe the kids would like.
Well, that was probably, again, a couple of years ago, one of the fun things that I tried on the carillon, and it works great, is Kanon's Waving Flag. And, I mean, the whole tower rocks with that one. I try to attract and engage the listener with something they recognize, and that's for every generation. I'll play tunes from World War II and World War I. Of course, this year is the centenary of World War I, so I'm paying homage to that. But also things from the 50s, 60s, and right up to Kanon. So the Peace Tower was called the Voice of the Nation when it was inaugurated by Prime Minister Mackenzie King, and it continues to speak to every generation.
Now, I guess the unfortunate fact of the job is that you don't only play in good times and every day, but you also have to play for very somber events. I remember hearing you play John Lennon's Imagine as Jack Layton's casket was being taken out of Parliament Hill. How is that for you to play things like state funerals?
It is a huge responsibility. A week of Jack Layton's passing and lying in state and the cortege as it left the hill was probably the most intense experience as a caroliner I've ever had, realizing the responsibility that I was making the Peace Tower speak for the nation. You know, there were huge crowds lining up to sign the Book of Remembrance and so forth. So that is a big responsibility, and it's pretty scary, actually.
Have you played other state funerals like that?
No. This spring, on a more informal basis, when Jim Flaherty passed away so unexpectedly and prematurely, it just totally blew away everyone on the Hill. And that was a Thursday afternoon. The next morning, I was supposed to play a regular program of some classical music, and I just said, no. That's not what people need or want to hear right now. So I switched to a medley of Irish tunes, and I think everyone appreciated that better.
I guess I'll move back away from that sort of emotional angle of this, but I guess one big question, when you look at this here, every note you hit is heard by the people outside. So how do you practice?
I tease everybody that since the carillon's on the seventh level of the Peace Tower, it's the highest office on the hill. But my real office is over in East Block, where there is an identical keyboard pedal board. It's called a practice carillon. And instead of being attached to bells, when I strike a key or a pedal there, a little hammer hits a tone bar and it sounds like a xylophone. So it really can't be heard outside of the room where I'm practicing. And I spend hours there practicing, adjusting and adapting music and teaching as well. You're right. When we're up here, it is very public, and I take, again, that responsibility of making sure there's good quality of music coming out of the tower. There's one exception to that. On Friday afternoons, between 3 and 4 in the afternoon, I give a group lesson to my carillon students in the tower. Now, they've been practicing on the practice keyboard here and at Carleton University, but the Friday afternoon is not a recital. They're going to stop, start, make mistakes, this, that, and the other. And the guides or the security guards, if can tell tourists who are alarmed by the sounds coming out of the tower that, don't worry, the Peace Tower's not broken. That's the next generation of Canadian caroliners.
What do you want to leave with Canadians when they come to the Hill, either as tourists or whether they're members of Parliament? What impact do you want to leave on this country by playing your instrument?
All caroliners realize that as players, they are passing through. I'm the fifth Dominion caroliner, and each of us has their own style and perhaps a musical legacy. I think my legacy will be teaching all these other students to come on beyond this. I am also very concerned about the fate of the Peace Tower Carillon through the huge amount of renovations that are going on Parliament Hill. And there will be a time where, as there has been before, where renovations are going on inside or outside the buildings. The Carillon's been silent a couple of times in its career for a year or two. I certainly hope when they work on Center Block in this huge plan that the Carillon won't be silent too long, and that certainly after I retire there will be more live human being recitals on it.
Is that a risk or a fear for you?
It's a fear, but it's still unclear what the Carillon's fate will be at this point. But I'm sure that the if we produce a lot of good music, people will want to hear it.
That was Canada's Dominion caroliner, Dr. Andrea McCready. The Carillon will likely be going silent by 2018 when the center block of Parliament Hill shuts down for major renovations. It could be closed for a whole decade.
That's it for this week's episode.
For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.